Okay, this is the Covenant of Life, part 10. We're up to chapter 18. And while this is not a super long chapter, I've divided it up because the next chapter is actually relatively long. So we're going to go probably maybe a little shorter this week to cover this chapter because we have a lot to cover next week. That said, this is a very important chapter in the course of things that have been discussed thus far. Chapter 18, question 457, what's the subject of chapter 18? The new heart of covenanters, the nature, characters, properties thereof, hitherto the new spirit. In other words, we want to talk about what it is, what what is the center of that renewed nature and in particular, remember we've talked about the difference between being an external covenanter and an internal or heart covenanter. And so we want to talk about, you know, the heart of those who are, in fact, internally and personally covenanted with God. What does that look like according to Scripture? And so Samuel Rutherford is going to do something in this chapter which Puritans elsewhere refer to as doing an anatomy of the heart. Very often you will have Puritans refer to something like that, the anatomy of the heart. Rutherford is going to examine our nature and consider, you know, what we are in our fallen estate and what happens in regeneration and how all of that changes. And so he's going to explain the ins and outs of this renewal and how this, in fact, relates to covenanting, this internal covenanting, which is so necessary. Remember, if you're in external covenant with God, you could be cut off. What profits you is not being in external covenant alone, but being in covenant with God internally, to be a heart covenanter, as, again, as Rutherford and others would say. A heart covenanting is a necessary thing. So, question 458, this chapter begins with the sixth question, and he's been asking a series of questions, and the sixth question is this. When are we to judge that we have a new heart? And when do we know that it's not the old heart? Now again, this is an important question because it's at that point we move from being formalists in our religion to being experientialists in our religion. Okay, to move from being an outward professor of the true faith to being someone who really sincerely believes. Now, Rutherford is giving this anatomy of the heart for your benefit, for my benefit, for everyone who reads him for their own personal benefit. Because a lot of what he's going to talk about here is not discernible to someone outside of yourself. Right, I can be, as some people would say today, I can be a fruit inspector, but what Rutherford is asking you to be here is a root inspector. And you're the only one who can sort of take a look at the root and see what's going on. right? The church can look at the fruit, but sometimes, you know, there's fruit, at least to our seeming, on a dying tree, right? Or a dead tree. But it won't last for long. You know, eventually, usually, these things make themselves manifest, right? The lack of spiritual life or sap is going to evidence itself in the lack of fruit eventually. There'll be something that will betray the fact that you're just a formalist. And while that is a question of interest to the church to some extent, it should be your number one priority in life to make your calling and election sure. Right? That should be your major concern as far as personal concern. Because, and really the reason is, you're even with respect to glorifying God, you know, you're not really going to glorify God if you're not elect, if you're not regenerate, because you can't obey the law from a proper motivation apart from the Spirit of God dwelling in you. You're not really going to glorify God in what you're doing, because you're not doing it from a proper motivation, which is why Solomon says that even the plowing of the wicked is sin. You know, something good and notable and civilly upright and virtuous even is accounted sin if the motive, the heart motive, isn't right. So this is a very, very important question for you, for me, for all of us. It's the first thing we have to answer if we really are going to glorify God. So if we really want to enter into the spirit of that first question in our catechism, chief end of man, to glorify God and enjoy him forever, you have to have this heart renovation. I mean, so how do we know? How do we judge we have a new heart? And when do we know it's not an old heart? Well, Rutherford lays down three propositions that he wants to give before answering. So, this is 459, number one, or A, he says that the heart is the man physically as well as morally. Good heart, a good man. An evil heart, an evil man. God weighs men not by the tongue or the hands or the outward man. God weighs the heart. So it gives some examples. 2 Chronicles 15:17. We're told that Asa's heart was perfect. 2 Chronicles 17:3. Jehoshaphat's heart was perfect. Now, you know, that's a relative perfection, but nonetheless, as to God, it was perfect because their hearts were not stayed in their own righteousness. They were, in fact, fixed upon the righteousness of Christ. So, that's the first thing that we need to remember. The second is, or B, that when the Lord tries a man, he tries the heart and reins. And by reins, we're talking about the affections of the heart, or affective faculties of the heart. I want to look at Proverbs 15:11. If somebody has Proverbs 15:11. And Proverbs 17:3, and also Jeremiah 17:9. So there are a lot of verses he gives here, but those are a few. let's look at Proverbs 15:11, 17:3, and then Jeremiah 17:9.
Proverbs 15, verse 11. Hell and destruction are before the Lord, how much more than the hearts of the children of men?
Proverbs 17:3.
Proverbs 17:3. The finding pot is for silver, and the furnace for gold, but the Lord trieth the hearts.
And Jeremiah 17:9.
Jeremiah 17, verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?
So, one thing that is clear is not only is a man determined by the state of his heart, that's what God is going to try. And he goes on to say that man's heart in a fallen state is such that it doesn't really work when a fallen man tries to examine his own heart. You know, the reason is, he doesn't talk about this so much here, but this idea of searching your heart, you have to remember that the Bible says that when you are unregenerate, you are in not just in a state of darkness, but the Bible actually calls you darkness. And so it's the question here is, you know, well, how do you search out? How does darkness search itself? Right? And this is where the problem is. And yet, as Rutherford is pointing out here, we know the Lord is trying the man by trying his heart. He's sifting it. He's making a trial of it. All right, the third proposition he wants to set forth here is this. That the washen heart, the washed heart, is purified by faith, and that's alone a good heart. We want to look at Acts 15:14. Somebody has that. Acts 15:14.
Verse 14. Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out them a people for his name.
So they've been purified. The idea is that they've been purified by faith. That this is a way that the heart is made clean or made good. So those are the first three propositions that Rutherford sets out. Now, there's a fourth proposition before he gets into giving his answer. And the fourth proposition has several points. The first three points are divided in question 460. The first three points are these. First of all, he says and points out that the creation of a better heart than the first, that is, your fallen state, your fallen heart, is a piece of the rarest of the Lord's works. Is one of those things that we can hardly we can hardly imagine. He says it's as rare as creating a piece. It's as rare as creating the sun out of nothing, or a beautiful lily out of mire and dirt. This is one of the rarest things that God will ever do, is to create a good heart or a better heart out of an unclean heart. And he does so, as we've already said, he purifies the heart by faith. And so that's how this changes. All right, 2, or B, he says it's an excellent act of God to keep the vessel in a spiritual season. That is, to make room for Christ dwelling by faith and for love to comprehend love. So, not only does he renew the heart, but it is also an excellent act of God when he keeps that renewed heart in that spiritual estate, which makes it receptive to divine influences. And then 3 or C, he notes that he bows and inclines the heart to the Lord's testimonies and to cleave to him without declining. And he gives us a few verses to that effect. I'm going to look at a couple of them. Jeremiah 32, 39 and 40. And let's look at Song of Solomon 1, 4. So Jeremiah 32, 39 and 40. And Song of Solomon 1, 4.
Jeremiah 32, 39, and 40. And I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me forever for the good of them and of their children after them. And I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them to do them good, but I will put fear in their hearts that they shall not depart from me.
Psalm 1, 4. Draw me, we will run after thee. The king hath brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will remember thy love more than wine. The upright love thee.
Okay. So this inclining of the heart to the Lord's testimonies, again, that's not something natural in a man. That's something God works in someone by his Spirit. And it's a gracious act on the part of God to do so. So in the 4th point, then, he gives us several things where he says we really need to beware. We need to take care, that we beware of these 3 things, and these are all things which are indications of heart trouble, and maybe remember he's talking about this question of how to know whether we have a new heart or there's still this old heart in us. And so he says the 3 things. He says, first of all, we should beware of the reigning evils of the heart, of having a rotten and an unsound heart. And he references 1 Timothy 6, verse 5, and Psalm 119, verse 82 here. 1 Timothy 6, 5, and Psalm 119, 82.
1 Timothy 6, verse 5. Perverse disputing of men of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, supposing that gain is godliness, from such withdraw thyself.
Psalm 119, verse
82.
Mine eyes fail for thy word, saying, when wilt thou comfort me?
Right, so we need to be aware of reigning evils. And he, by that, he's talking about what we might describe as habits of sin. Areas where, not where we're struggling with sin, but where sin appears to have dominion. Right, where we're being overmastered. We need to be careful of that and beware of that. That's one of those warning signs that there's something wrong. It's one kind of evil that we have in our heart. Two, he says we should beware of an unsavory and stinking heart that smells of hell and the second death, of all sort of unrighteousness and malice, like a green opened grave. By which he means a fresh grave that is open, so you can smell the stench coming out of it. We want to look at Psalm 5, verse 9. Psalm 5, verse 9.
Psalm 5, verse 9. For there is no faithfulness in their mouth, their inward part is very wickedness. Their throat is an open sepulchre. They flatter with their tongue.
Yeah, so a stinking heart is a heart which is filled with uncleanness and malice. And what he calls the stench of the grave. Right, the fresh grave. So we need to... as we're mulling over the difference between a new heart and an old heart, he's saying, take this into account. These things are not good. These things are indicative. These are what we would call counter indicators, right? You can have these other things going on over here, which might indicate a new heart, but Rutherford's saying, pause for a moment and consider. Right? Take your spiritual pulse. So third, he says, beware of what he calls an uncured heart that never came through the hands of a physician. An unsound, unsavory, and rotten heart. References Psalm, or excuse me, Proverbs 14:13, a sound heart is the life of the flesh. So to have an unsound heart, an uncured heart, is to it's discovered by, he says, the issue of rotten words and think about the things that you think about, talk about, are interested in doing. How much of this is really conducive to building up of yourself or others in the true faith? Right? How much of it is concerned with the spiritual well-being of yourself and those around you? If it's not, then you probably need to step back and ask yourself, is there something going on here? Is there a problem? That's why he's saying beware of an uncured heart. That is an unrenewed heart. So, 5, his fifth point, he mentions in this branches of what he calls deadness of heart. And so he says, here are the branches of deadness of heart. These are the five branches that he lays out. And then after that, in 463, we're going to see there are really three more points that he's going to sort of tie to that. So the first branch is that there's a sullenness and sadness in refusing comforts and being full of unbelieving heaviness. There's a difference, by the way, you know, I think he's saying, between people who maybe lack comfort. He's really talking about people here who are refusing to be comforted. Whereas he points out we're always to rejoice. All right, the second he says this deadness of heart is displayed in fainting at the greatness of the affliction, from whence there comes a withering of the heart. So again, this is I think, indicative of a lack of faith to some extent. You know, it's he references a number of verses here, but the one that really comes to my mind he doesn't have here, and that is, when Cain receives his sentence, and he says, you know, my punishment is more than I can bear. You know, why is his punishment more than he can bear? I mean, you know, consider he killed his brother, right? And God says that he's going to bear the mark of that iniquity, and he faints under that. That's the mark of deadness of heart, right? Rather than having recourse to God in all of that, you know, he's just saying, I can't, this is more than I can bear. You know, faith keeps coming back to God. It doesn't, you know, when, like, the remember the woman with the issue, or excuse me, whose daughter had the issue, the Syrophoenician woman who needed to be healed, her daughter needed to be healed. And she comes to Jesus, and first of all, you know, he tells her, you're a Gentile. Why would I heal you? And she's persistent in it, right? That's faith. But Cain, on the other hand, just takes this attitude, my affliction is more than I can bear. You know, the people who had faith are exercising it, and they're pushing through crowds in the Gospels. They're pressing into the crowd to get to Jesus. They're not seeing that as an obstacle. They're not perceiving those things as insurmountable. Cain is one of these people who withers under it. And he withers when the withering actually started when his sacrifice wasn't accepted, and then he kills his brother. And then he can't handle the punishment for doing that. So I think that's kind of what he's talking about here. All right, third, or C, another branch of deadness of heart, is an overwhelmed and unbelieving, swooning heart. We'll look at Psalm 61:2, and let's look at Psalm 142:3 on this one. Psalm 61:2 and Psalm 142:3.
Psalm 61, verse 2. From the end of the earth will I cry unto thee. When my heart is overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I.
And Psalm 142:3.
Psalm 142, verse 3. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then thou knewest my path, the way wherein I walked, have they privily laid a snare for me.
So, again, faith does not allow itself to remain in this overwhelmed, swooning condition. Right? There's a comeback from that. But there's a deadness when it's overwhelmed. Another branch of deadness of heart, 4 or D, there's a deadness in going about the service of God. So in Psalm 119:37, the psalmist says, quicken me in thy way. And then fifth, he notes that there is the narrowness to take in God opposed to an enlarged and wide heart. Deadness of heart, there's a straightening of the heart when the soul is so hampered it can't speak. He says unbelief clips the wings of the spirit. So actually he goes on with a few more things that he sets forth as points here. The next 3 points mentioned are as follows. 463. And these, I think, also all have go through this deadness of heart, as does the ninth point that he brings. In fact, there are a number of points after some questions which are as well to the deadness of heart. And so I'll keep trying to relate them back to deadness of heart until we move on to the newness of heart. So, what are the next 3 points of deadness of heart? Well, sixth, or A, it's actually point A here. He says there's an atheist heart to hate the existence of God, Christ, the gospel, and so on. Right. That's something to, I think, take into our account. You know, atheism never is really just, I don't believe there's a God. He's pointing out there's this heart hatred, the very idea of the existence of God, or of Christ, or the gospel. When people are talking that way, you know you're dealing with a dead heart. Right? Not everyone talks that way, but some people do, and that's a pretty good indication. You know, so if, in Rutherford's saying, if you have any of this in you, right, that's an indication to you. Again, take account, take your spiritual pulse. All right, the seventh point, or B in this question. He says there's an evil heart of unbelief to depart from the living God, which is a paraphrase of Hebrews 3:12. That too is part of a branch of deadness of heart. And then the eighth point, or C in this question, says it's a branch of deadness of heart when you have a heart that devises, plows, or delves wicked imaginations. I'm going to look at Proverbs 6:18 on that. Proverbs 6:18.
Proverbs 6, verse 18. In heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief.
Yeah, heart that deviseth. I think the word that he points out here in the margin is that word is to plow, to delve or plow. That the idea is, you know, it's not just an imagination, but there's sort of this, you know, plotting and planning that is carried along with it to do evil. So when the thoughts of your heart are evil and set to do evil and all of that, again, that's indication that there's deadness of heart. At 464, there's a ninth point that he brings up, and in it, in the ninth point, he indicts a proud heart as being one of those things which is an indication of deadness of heart. If you have a proud heart, and there are three reasons why he says that this is an indication of deadness of heart. Right? First, A, 464, he says that a proud heart is resisted of God. God resisteth the proud. And that makes it part of deadness of heart. Two, or B, he says, a proud heart is farthest from the lowly and meek heart of Christ. So it's a heart that is least like Christ, or even with Moses, far from Moses. You know, why is Moses the meekest man on earth? Because you have to be to submit to the law of God. The pride of the heart is not only resisted by God, it is far from that meekness of Christ. And then 30 says it's most near to Satan's heart. So when you have pride of heart, when you're proud-hearted, he's saying you're most like the devil. All of which argue that having a proud heart is, in fact, to be like, to be possessed of deadness of heart. And he asked a couple of questions here about this particular issue. The first question he raises, and this is really a very interesting question. But he says, why is it we're more ashamed of an unclean and lustful heart than we are of a proud heart? And he says, in answer to this, 466, and I think this is really, really an interesting point. He says that a proud heart is deeper guiltiness and nearer to Satan's nature. Because pride and unbelief are sins more reproachful to God. But he says the fact is we are more fleshly, right? We have more of the flesh in us than in the spirit, and so we think that uncleanness is worse than pride. And he basically says, what he's getting at is, we are more ashamed of violations of the second table of the law, our duty toward men, than we are with respect to violations of the first table of the law. And that is such a common thing, isn't it? When you think about it. There are people who will admit that, you know, there's something wrong with the with sexual immorality or dishonoring your parents or murder or stealing, all of those kinds of things, lying, which we're going to come to in a moment. But when it comes to idolatry or blasphemy or Sabbath breaking, most people minimize it, try to justify it, don't see it as serious a matter. And that, and I think Rutherford is indicating here, that way of thinking is already indicative of the fact that there's too much deadness of heart. Right? Why is it you are more concerned with the second table than the first? You know, because all of your thoughts are about this world and things in this world. I think that's really what he's saying here. If you were not such a worldling, if you weren't so caught up in the things of this world, if you were more spiritually minded, you would realize that it's much more serious to be caught up in this pride of heart. It's much more serious than to attack the being of God in that way. Right? And people don't probably think about it that way, but that's ultimately what you're doing. It's an affront to God. It's a species of idolatry. But people don't see it that way. Because they're, as Rutherford says here, they're more beastly. All right, the next question. Second question Rutherford raises here. 467. Yeah. He says, but we're more ashamed of lying, falsehood, and stealing than of pride. Why are we more ashamed? And again, he's his answer, 468, is this: we are more ashamed before men than we are before God. Pride, he says, is more of an angel or spiritual sin than a carnal sin. But carnal sins, they catch our attention because actually, the more wicked you are, the more dead you are to God, the more focused you are going to be on carnal, what we would call carnal sins. Right? You're going to see them more clearly as potential problems in your ability to justify yourself on Judgment Day. Your focus is on worldly things. All right, with that, he gets back into some of these branches of deadness of heart. So we want to look at the next two. point 10 and 11. At 469, what are the next 2 points concerning the heart? He says, well, we need to keep in mind that there is a deceitfulness and self-deceiving in the heart. He points here to Isaiah 44:20. We want to look at that. And also Obadiah 3, because we probably don't look at Obadiah enough. So let's look at those verses. Isaiah 44:20 and Obadiah 3.
Isaiah 44:20. He feedeth on ashes, a deceived heart hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand?
Obadiah, verse 3, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground?
So, he says that the heart is the greatest liar on earth. The saying gainsays. It is a self-deceiving. And if you remember from, I think it was last week, what we covered here, he says that self-deceit is the worst kind of delusion. All right. The second point here concerning the heart, 11, it's point 11 in the Covenant of Life Open, on deadness of heart, 11th branch, says there is a wicked fearfulness in the heart to do evil. But the godly tremble at feasting, speaking, hearing, sleeping, company, etc. It's a godly fear to tremble at those things. But it's there's a wicked fearfulness in the heart to do evil. Jude 12, he quotes, feeding themselves without fear. And so he goes on. All right. I think what he's getting at here is in the wicked, in deadness of heart, a deadness of heart. there is, I think, what he's indicating is. The there's actually whereas the godly are fearing that they might do evil, there's in the wicked he's indicating there's almost this fear that they're not going to do enough evil. But anyway, all right, 470, and this is getting into the 12th character of deadness of heart. He says there's a wicked flintiness of the heart, and he describes that, the characteristics of it, in six things. He says, first of all, the wicked heart, the flinty heart, says, we shall have peace, though we both hear cursing and walk loosely. By flintiness of heart, he's talking about hardness of heart. Right? So what do those who are hard-hearted, the wicked who are hard-hearted, say? They think, first of all, he says they think they're going to have peace even though they walk in a loose manner and they curse God. Right, second or B, he says that characteristic of a wicked flintiness of heart, that it will rise whether God will or not. In other words, it's going to pursue its own desire. Look, he gives us here Isaiah 9:9.
Isaiah 9:9. And all the people shall know, even Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, that say in the pride and stoutness of heart.
Yeah, pride and stoutness of heart he's talking about. So they rise up, heart rises in pride, whether or not God would have it to be so. All right, 3 or C, he points out its characteristic of hardness of heart to be like the king of Assyria's stout heart, which would be as strong as God. And he references Isaiah 10:12-13 for that. We're not going to look at it, but I just want you to know. He's referencing, again, a number of verses throughout here. Just a few that we'll look at. But 4, yeah, it's characteristic of wicked hardness of heart. And the character of wicked stoutness to say that godly mourning before the Lord is in vain. So, you know, that's sort of like when people tell you you don't really have to do all of that, you know, you don't, they're really trying to convince you not to fear God. All right, 5, E. He says, it's wicked stoutness to rest upon your own righteousness and refuse to treat with God. That is to come to God for relief there. And 6, sinful flintiness or stoniness of heart against God is displayed in this vain stoutness which is such as to dare God in his own quarters and fight him. Right, so now Rutherford gives another 4 points respecting this hardness or flintiness of heart and this deadness of heart that he's talking about. These are points.
Yeah.
Where he is saying these things need to be noted and avoided. So, first of all, or 13, really, he says there is a wicked hardening of the heart. When men want to make the Lord and his word and mighty works the contrary party. In other words, when they want to set God in opposition to his word and works. That's a wicked hardening of the heart. And I'll tell you, I think one of the most common ways that manifests itself verbally, at least, is when you have people who will tell you, you know, my God isn't like that. Right? They set God against his word and his works. And that dichotomy, by the way, has become a justification for all kinds of really, really wicked and perverse stuff. It's become a cover for the pressing of rights for sodomites and other demonically possessed and thoroughly perverted people to claim some right or some guarantee to not just a tolerance but to a loving acceptance by society. You know, you can only do that by separating God from his word and his works. You see, you've created God after your own mind. However you do it, Rutherford is saying it's deadness of heart. There's a deadness of heart indicated by that. All right, 2 or B, again, 1471. He says that there's a sinful dullness upon the heart. By which men are as weaned children, that line upon line can do them their good. Yeah. All right. That was point 14. 15, or in our case here, C, 3, or C, 471. Another thing to be noted and avoided concerning the heart is, he says there's a froward heart that perverts and is crafty to pervert.
Yeah.
And then he says, in point 16, there's a wicked heart, which is bound and set upon all kind of evil, assembling, and so on. And so he says that he points that there are two marks that he gives here, that the heart is wicked and set on evil, 472. The first is that we do not heed, we take no heed to the imaginations, we're not grieved for the constitution of the heart, for actual sins make original sin to swell, as two floods running into one makes a huge river. In other words, the mark that a heart is wicked and set on evil is it doesn't take heed, it's not grieved over the wickedness of the heart. Two or B, it's a mark of a heart that's wicked and set on evil, but it doesn't take heed to what Rutherford calls here young young births of evil in the heart. There's no concern to root them out. So, in other words, it's like a garden unweeded. Weeding gardens is a good way to meditate on weeding sin out of your life. Like 473. What are four vain and unreasonable imaginations of the wicked heart? He says that the four things are this, four vain and unreasonable imaginations. First is this. The heart, the wicked heart says, what if there is no God? He references Psalm 14:1, right? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Second imagination, a vain and unreasonable imagination of wicked heart, and this one he's going to reference Ezekiel 9:9, if somebody can get that, Ezekiel 9:9. But it is this, what if God doesn't see? The first is, you know, what if there is no God? The second is, okay, so maybe there is a God, but what if he doesn't see it? Which, by the way, is the reason, one reason why men are more prone to sin in private than in public. Right? There's much more temptation. You know, most people are not really swayed by this, what if there is no God? But a lot of people, I think, are swayed by this, what if he doesn't see it? So if I do it in the dark, if I do it in private, if I do it, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, if there are no witnesses, you know, it's sort of like that question, you know, if a tree falls in the woods and there's no one there to hear it, did it make a sound? You know, so it's really a sin if God didn't see it. What if God doesn't see? Look at Ezekiel 9:9.
Ezekiel 9, verse 9. Then said he unto me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceeding great, and the land is full of blood, and the city full of perverseness. For they say, the Lord hath forsaken the earth, and the Lord seeth not.
For the third question, or unreasonable, vain and unreasonable imagination, it's a question that I like, in fact, the way he's putting these questions, because it's really what's happening. You're questioning God, right? You're questioning the reality of God. And so the third question, and this we're going to look at Ecclesiastes 3:19 for this, Ecclesiastes 3:19. The third question is, what if man perish as the beast do? That is, if he's like a beast, he dies. The idea is, so there's no heaven, there's no hell. Just perishes like an animal. Ecclesiastes 3:19.
Ecclesiastes 3, verse 19. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts, even one that befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity.
And the fourth vain and unreasonable imagination of the wicked heart. And he references, I do want to look at this verse, Acts 18:14-15. But he says, what if there is no gospel, or no Christ, no gospel, only questions of words? And this is that, and we want to look at Acts 18:14-15. But this is that question, or that objection that people raise when they say, that's your interpretation, right? It's a question of words. As if, you know, they're prepared to give you their interpretation and live by it, right? That's your interpretation of the Bible. Why don't you tell me your interpretation of the Bible, and then you man up and live by that? Because I would wager, if I were a gambling sort of person, and I'm not, we've talked about that, but if I were, I would wager that they, A, don't have a cogent interpretation, or in the unlikelihood that they do have some kind of interpretation, that they're not prepared to live by it. Right? So they probably don't have a cogent interpretation, certainly aren't going to live by it. And these are people for whom there's no certainty in life anyway. Everything is a question of words. It's your interpretation. Everything in life for them is a wax nose. You can move it this way or that way, and it's just a matter of at best, it's a matter of running the probability charts, right? There's no certainty. Can't have any kind of certainty, and without certainty, of course, there's no possibility of truth. So there's no Christ, there's no gospel, just a bunch of question of words. Anyway, look at Acts 18:14-15.
Acts 18:14-15. And when Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said unto the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, O ye Jews, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names and of your law, look ye to it, for I will be no judge of such matters.
So those are the vain, you know, unreasonable imaginations of wicked hearts. Right. Now, as we come to the end of this chapter, Rutherford turns and he wants to give us several notes of a new heart. And so, first of all, the first five things that he tells us about a new heart, 474, number one, or A, he says, look, a new heart is the office house of Christ, and a heart delighting in God's ways. It's a place where the law is imprinted and engraven. So consequently, you know, he says that the gospel is a delightful thing. The law is a thing that he likes. You know, there's a delighting in Christ. All of this is true of a new heart. In other words, a heart delights in Christ and the salvation that he brings. All right, the second thing, or B, he notes is this, that the new heart is a universal heart. It is holy for God as God. You know, he says external things you can divide. Right? You could be a hearing professor of the true religion, a drunken professor of the true religion, a praising or singing professor of the true religion in public, and a not praying, a not believing professor in private, in spiritual duties. He says a new heart isn't like that, right? You can't have half a cartwheel. Doesn't work. He doesn't mean doing a cartwheel. He's talking about a wheel on a cart.
No.
We would say half a car wheel. Wouldn't get you very far. So there is, in this, actually, this question, this has to do with questions of simplicity versus complexity. And Rutherford is of the mind, as were most, I think, of the theologians at this time, and I would agree with them, that external things are divisible. They're complex, corporeal things. But spiritual things are not like that. They're of a simpler nature, not divisible like that, right? If you take anything out of what is spiritual, it ceases to be what it professed to be. So it either is or isn't. So spirit, in terms of spiritual realities, Rutherford is saying you're either on or you're off. You know, in externals, you can divide this up. And you could sometimes be this and sometimes be that. Right? You could be the professor of true religion, you know, when you're at worship. And you could also be a professor of true religion when you're getting drunk with the boys, okay? That may be divisible in the external world, but he's saying in terms of the heart, we're talking about something that can't be divided like that. And so if you try to make this kind of division, if you try to make this sort of separation, the fact is, you end up losing the whole, because it's either on or it's off. All right. Three or C. He says, a new heart is fixed and established by grace. It's a new state of being. It's not a new transient flash. It's a new heart. It's not just moving through something, but it is actually becoming something different. Right. Four or D. He says that, and he quotes from 1 Samuel 10:9, God gave Saul another heart. He says, a changed heart then is not a new heart. And he goes on to say, it's not the newness that makes the heart new. Rather, it's God's new engraving. In other words, it's when the law is written in the heart. That makes a new heart. All right, fifth, for E. He says, a heart kept with all keeping is a new heart. A new heart is well kept and well guarded heart. There's a diligence that he notes that surrounds a new heart. Finally, he in question 475, he finishes by speaking about the heart being new, and he basically says that there are in a new heart new affections. And so he lists what they are. So the first, or A, is the heart is new where the affections are all faith and all sanctified. Says as well that the heart's new when the affections are equivocally or at in a secondhand sort of way set on the creature. When God is first and foremost to be feared and served, and so on. So, the consideration of the creature is in a somewhat lesser way. New heart sets the affections on the Creator first. And then, finally, 3 or C, he says that nothing is all good and all desirable but God and God in Christ. When you have a new heart, there's nothing all good and all desirable except God in Christ. So that's really what he would have you know. So, in conclusion, he's given us a lot to think about with respect to the state of a dead heart or deadness of heart or the old heart, the carnal heart, the fallen nature. And he's contrasted it with the attitudes and affections of a new heart. When you're doing this heart anatomy, when you're taking inventory, saying these are things that you should be examining. You know, if you find these indicators of deadness of heart, be concerned. You know, if you find these indications of newness of heart, rejoice. But be circumspect. Don't allow these other things to crop up. These are impediments. You want to keep a new heart, is going to keep itself well guarded. And one of the best ways to guard is to know the difference between, you know, weeds and something that you want growing. All right, so next time, chapter 19, we're going to get into the question of evangelical works and a number of other things, how works. We'll get into some discussion from the Epistle of James and the place of works with respect to the gospel, and how all of this is to be understood in a reformed and evangelical manner, and not falling into all kinds of popish delusions and so on. So next time we'll be looking at chapter 19.